Okay, we're going to start. Hi, everybody. Welcome. We are doing class number two today in our Explorers series. Let me just get to the beginning of our PowerPoint. Okay, so the title here, last time. Let's back up a second. Okay. Last time we talked about the earliest archaeologists in the land of Israel. Largely, we were looking at non-Jews, right? We were looking at Christians, British, Americans. We had a few Jews scattered in there here and there. Today, what we're going to be looking at are Jewish archaeologists and, really more to the point, Israeli archaeologists. And the title here is a bit of a pun. On a famous saying that about the army, which is Am bonet tzava bonet am. The people builds an army which builds the people, right? And if you know anything about Tzal, about the Israeli army, it's very much it is very much a melting pot, right? It's a way to acculturate. It's a way to become part of Israeli society. And it also builds up Israeli society through education programs, through all different kinds of programs. I was playing with that and talking about archaeology, building a nation, archaeology as part of our Zionist story, right? So we have here, obviously, I hope everybody recognizes the old guy in the middle, right? That's David Ben-Gurion, of course. To the right of him is Yigael Yadin, who we're going to mention briefly today. People who don't have audio, I am guessing it is your computers. I hope everybody else is hearing me. Give me a thumbs up that you're
Hear you.
hearing. Yes. Okay, if someone does not have audio, then yes, try leaving and logging on. That is always my approach. Turn it off and turn it back on. Okay, so we're going to get to Yigael Yadin. We're going to talk about him more when we get to the whole story of Tanakh, which and David Ben-Gurion as well, right? Tanakh and archaeology. But this is really Zionism and archaeology. And how is Zionism part of our claim to this land, right? How is archaeology part of our claim to this land? If we show that we've been here for millennia, right? That's part of our Zionist story. So this is a picture of Ben-Gurion with Yadin in Tel Chatzor, up in the north, in 1958. But what I really wanted to bring you, we can bring lots of pictures, but I wanted to bring you this poem because it's a great poem. I apologize for bringing it only in Hebrew, but I will translate it as I go along. Okay? This is a poem written by probably Israel's most celebrity poet in the 30s, 40s, 50s. You may not have heard of him because he's not like Bialik or Agnon, but if you lived in Israel in the 40s, Natan Alterman was your guy. He was known as a poet who wrote deep and literary poems, but he also wrote a weekly column called Hatur Hashvi'i, which almost always commented on current events. And he actually, the very famous poem, which became a song called Magash HaKesef, right? The silver platter. Our young men and women are the silver platter upon which the state was given to you. That's written by Natan Alterman. So this is a somewhat of a lighter poem. It's called Ha'ir HaChadasha, the New City, written, published on December 24th, 1948. So very close to our date today. Published on the occasion of excavations beginning in an area that today is within the campus of the Eretz Yisrael Museum in North Tel Aviv, okay? Not so far from Tel Aviv University. This was a tell called Tel Kasila. We're gonna come back to it a little bit later. And there were excavations that were done here that showed that it was a Philistine city before, 3 millennia ago. And this poem is about this discovery. And I didn't bring you the whole thing, just pieces of it. Nistakel ba'uvdot v'nabit gam ba'reka. We'll look at the facts and also the background. Hinei shar chatzer chadarim dira. Here's a gate, a courtyard, rooms, an apartment. Eh, akeret habayit. Where's the housewife? Yes, ala lirega b'mea hashminit shelifnei haspira. She went out for a minute in the 8th century BCE. And he goes on to describe who was here and when and what. And then he concludes in these two very stirring paragraphs. Hanes po eno birits pa hamozait mikidmat medina Israel shebatel. This is the miracle here is not in the mosaic floor that existed before the state of Israel. Lo, Hanes hushazo habait medina Israel. The miracle here is that the floor and the house are being dug with the license of the state of Israel. Tel Kasila was the first site that was licensed by what was the antiquities was already then, it had a different name, right, for archaeologist Binyamin Mazar to dig. So the miracle is here we are digging in our own state with our own archaeologists. Et hakrav hayudi shenatash lo lehevel Abba Evan masbir leumot bimisiban, right? The Jewish battle that he is constantly waging, Abba Ibn, right? We know Abba Ibn. He explains it to the nations as they sit around. But now he's going to play with that word, Abba Evan, right? Evan, the father of stone. Yafe shemeomek yamim ima Evan midaberet gam hi ba'ota ha'inyan. It's nice that from the depths of the past, Mother Stone, right? Mother Earth is also speaking about the same thing. So in short, right, we can talk and we can talk in the United Nations and all sorts of other forums, but what we can show as our claim on this land is the centuries upon centuries that we've been living here, right? And that's part of our story today is archaeology in going hand in hand with Zionism. Okay, as we like to do, we're going to start with a short timeline. What we're going to be talking about today spans from the time of the British Mandate when we have the first Jewish archaeologist, not Israeli yet because we don't have the state of Israel yet, the opening of the Rockefeller Museum under the auspices of the British, okay? And we're going to go into the early years of the state where we have some very important excavations going on and the early excavations and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we're going to continue talk about a very important mission to rescue all kinds of artifacts from caves in the Judean Desert in 1960. And then we have this watershed moment, of course, of the Six-Day War, which is a watershed moment in many, many ways, but it also is a watershed moment in archaeology because suddenly we're able to go and to excavate in the old city of Jerusalem. We're able to excavate in the Golan and in Yehuda and Shomron, right? So we'll talk a little bit about that. Basically, we're going to talk about various places, but we're going to focus it on people, right? On the archaeologists themselves and the places that they dug. But we're going to start with the Rockefeller Museum. Anyone who's been to the British Museum in London or the Metropolitan Museum in New York knows that in the 19th century, right, when all these amazing places were being discovered in Assyria, in Egypt, the custom was take the stuff home with you, right? Bring it back to the British Museum or the Met or the Louvre or your private collection if you're a real robber baron in New York. And in the 1930s, the British had this very interesting idea, which was, why don't we keep the stuff here? Why don't we keep the stuff in the country where it's founded? This is partly because there are a lot of important digs that start to happen in the 1920s and the 1930s. It's partly because the British have a different attitude towards the Holy Land than they do to, let's say, places like Assyria. This is the Holy Land. Maybe the stuff should stay here. And they decide to build a beautiful monumental museum that's going to be a place that's going to showcase the fact that here we are in the cradle of monotheism, the great religions that are housed here, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the meetings of East and West, the beginnings of Western civilization, right? All of those very, very big ideas. In order to do all those big ideas, obviously you need a money guy. And fortunately for them, John D. Rockefeller Jr., he of Rockefeller Center, is it him or his father or his son? I don't know. Okay, but we all know the name Rockefeller, was supposed to build a museum in Cairo, an archaeological museum, also under the auspices of the British. That plan fell through. It was supposed to cost $10 million. 1930s, $10 million, right? This is not a cheap building. And they come to him, the British, and they say, look, you could build something in Jerusalem for a fifth of that for $2 million. It's a real bargain. And he says, great, I'm going to do it. What site do they pick? They pick a very interesting site at the northeast corner of the old city, outside the old city, right? It's right between Lion's Gate on the east and Herod's Gate and Damascus Gate on the north. It's a very large site. It used to be an Arab sheikh's private land and villa. It goes on sale. Boris Schatz, the founder of Bezalel, right, of the art school, the first Jewish art school in 3,500 years, he really wants to buy this land. It doesn't work out. And in the end, it's bought for the British Museum. It's meant, and we're going to see the architecture in a minute, but it's meant to echo famous structures both in the East and in the West. If you see the courtyard here, if you've been to Spain and to the Alhambra, it's meant to echo that. The pool and this beautiful courtyard. Inside, there are elements that look like cathedrals, but there are also Eastern elements. And the idea is to bring together all these different things. The architect is a British guy named Austin St. Barbie Harrison. He builds a lot of important buildings in British Mandate Jerusalem. And despite his very aristocratic British sounding name, he actually loved the Mediterranean. He lived in Greece, he lived in Israel, he loved it here. And he really combines all these different elements. The picture on the right, okay, is a picture from something that we're going to talk about later, and that's the many, 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 many fragments of Dead Sea Scrolls that were brought and housed in the museum when it was under Jordanian control between 1948 and 1967. Okay, so that's the other thing that makes this museum famous. But we're going to go back to its founding. Like we said, bringing in all different elements. So they brought in Armenian tile artists named David Ohanessian to create this gorgeous Armenian tile here on the left. Right? In the exhibits, they wanted to showcase, like we said, prehistory, right, and the great empires, ancient empires like Egypt. So you have artifacts from the Egyptian controlled city of Beit Sha'an, like we have on the right here. But they also wanted to bring in stuff from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So there are panels from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and there are mosaics from synagogues, and there's what you have here in the middle, which is kind of insane to imagine this happening today. But these are wooden panels from Al-Aqsa, okay? From Al-Aqsa on the Temple Mount, the Muslims were replacing these very, very old, 1,000-year-old wooden panels. And the British said, can we have them? And the Muslims said, sure, right? And they put them in this museum. So it really is an attempt to bring together all the cultures, all the religions. Everybody's going to live here in harmony. Okay, the very first day for the grand opening. This is January 1938. Archaeologists, of course, are coming from all over. All sorts of dignitaries are invited. And there's an archaeologist, a British archaeologist named Starkey, who's working on what eventually is known as Tel Lachish. Okay, out in the Shvela, out in the lowlands, not so far from Beit Shemesh, and he's coming to this event, and he's attacked on the road by Arab terrorists, and he's murdered, which kind of puts a damper on the whole opening ceremonies. But there's this ideal of how wonderful this is going to be, and then there's the reality. Okay, so from the Rockefeller Museum, which is still around, and okay, I see somebody asked you, are Dead Sea Scrolls still in the Rockefeller Museum? So we're going to come to the Dead Sea Scrolls, but no. After 1967, Israel took over the Rockefeller Museum and took over the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. Some of them were never in the Rockefeller Museum, and we'll get to that story, which is a nice segue into our first archaeologist here, Professor Eliezer Lipa-Sukenik, who, as you can see in the picture here on the left, is examining very closely one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we're going to come to his story with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Eliezer Sukenik sometimes gets short shrift. He's described as the father of Yigael Yadin, who, of course, is the ultimate Israeli archaeologist. Anybody, if you know one Israeli archaeologist, chances are good you know Yigael Yadin. But that's not very fair to Eliezer Sukenik because he was really a very significant person in his own right. He was one of the founders of the archaeology department in the Hebrew University. He did the very first Jewishly run dig in Beit Alpha. We're going to see that in a minute. Over here on the right, I have the picture on the bottom right here. This is on the campus of Hebrew University on Mount Scopus, founded in 1941. It's called Beit HaNechot LaAtikot HaYudim. Beit HaNechot is an old word, a biblical term for a treasure house. It's in Sefer Yeshayahu. Okay? And this was meant to be the treasure house for Jewish antiquities. And the idea was that all Jewish antiquities were going to end up in this building. Sukenik plans it. There's a South African donor who funds it. And it's meant to be what today we know the Israel Museum is. Why doesn't it become that? Because, like everything that was planned for the Mount Scopus Hebrew University, it's all broken up by what happens in 1948, right? 1948, the city is divided. Mount Scopus stays in Israeli hands, but as kind of a military post, you can't get there back and forth there. So the Hadassah Hospital that was supposed to be there is not used. And the Pantheon of Graves that was supposed to be there is not used. And the treasure house of the Jewish people. Also, the Israel Museum is created instead. But this was the original idea, was that the Museum of Archaeology and Antiquities was going to be on Mount Scopus, and it was planned by Eliezer Sukenik. Another project that he takes part in, very, very significant project, is what you see here on the top right. Encyclopedia Mikra'it, right? Biblical Encyclopedia, which brought together the scholars of Bible and of archaeology to create a modern scientific way of looking at Tanakh, but from a Jewish perspective, right? This is not the documentary hypothesis and a lot of anti-Semitism in those ideas. This was meant to come at things from a scientific perspective, but a Jewish scientific perspective. The idea for it was already suggested in 1942. But the first volume only comes out in 1947, which is also a very dramatic year in Israel, right? If you think about those years, 1942 to 1947, and what's happening to the Jewish people in Europe, in Israel, it's insane to imagine that this scientific endeavor is going forward, but it really is. And in the introduction, Sukenik writes that really it took so long to get out. It was very delayed because of the events in the land. Ha'mo'ra'ot ba'aretz. Vahatzlaot ha'kashot sha'avru al Yerushalayim, and the hardships that happened to Jerusalem, right? That's very much playing down what's going on. So Encyclopedia Mikra'it, he was the editor, one of the editors, and really one of the people, the brains behind this project. He first comes into the public light in archaeology in a place called Beit Alpha. Okay, Beit Alpha, if you have in the map here, right up here in the Jezreel Valley, not too far from Beit She'an. Two kibbutzim founded there, one called Beit Alpha, one called Chefsiba. And as the pioneers, as the farmers are working the ground, they hit something that is clearly not dirt, and it's a mosaic floor. And they call in Sukenik, and he calls in other people from Hebrew University, and they start to uncover it, and they discover this magnificent synagogue floor mosaic, which you can see here on the right. You can go see it in Beit Alpha. Almost everything you see is original, not
I brought
restored.
me
Yes, they it up,
No.
right? But it's in amazing, amazing condition. And you can imagine these guys, these farmers, right? They're chalutzim. They've come back. They want to be returning to the land after centuries and centuries. And suddenly they're getting this hello, hello from their ancestors from the 5th, 6th century of the Common Era. And we know when it's from because there's an inscription on the bottom that tells us in Greek when this floor was made, when the synagogue was renovated. So it's really, it's a perfect example of what we're talking about, that here are these guys coming back to the land and they're discovering their antecedents and connecting up to them. So Sukenik runs that excavation. And Beit Alpha is fascinating. Since Beit Alpha, we've uncovered dozens of ancient synagogues, many of them with mosaics. But this is the first time that we're confronted, archaeologists are confronted by a synagogue that has all these things that you say, whoa, whoa, wait a second. This doesn't sound like what the rabbis are talking about. There's images here. And not only are there
There's body
images from the
inhabitants there.
biblical story,
Oh yeah,
right?
looks so.
You have these this image here of the Akedah, right? The binding of Isaac. So you've got images of a biblical story. Okay, yeah, maybe we don't like that so much, but at least it's a biblical story. But we also have images of the zodiac. Take a look on the right here. We have the zodiac. We have women dressed up to portray the seasons. We have an image of Helios, the sun god, with his chariot. What the heck is going on here, right? And this is the beginning of reassessing this whole idea of what was accepted. Did people follow everything the rabbi said about imagery? Were there different ideas? And it's just began a fascinating conversation about what is Jewish art, which is still ongoing today because we're still finding all kinds of things that were clearly made by Jews and sometimes were in synagogues, and yet they seem to us to be, wow, how could they have had that? So we won't go too much into that, but it's just interesting to know about. The other thing Sukenik is famous for is the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay, I think we all more or less know the story. We'll just tell it very briefly, right? Over here, where I made it nice and purple on this map of Israel, okay, you have the area of Qumran and of the cliffs there. One day, late in 1947, a Bedouin boy from the area goes out with his flock of goats. One of the goats runs up the cliff, escapes into some cave. He's looking for it. He throws a stone in. He hears a sound. He kind of feels his way into the cave and pulls out not a goat, but a jar. And in the jar are scrolls. And he doesn't know what these scrolls are. Eventually, he brings them home. The Bedouin tribe bring scrolls to Bethlehem, okay, to an antiquities dealer named Khalil Iskander Shahin, who's known as Kondo. Kondo has a buddy whose name is Eliezer Sukenik. Okay? And he calls him and he says, why don't you come out and take a look at these and see what they are? And he comes and he says, I know this text. This is the book of Isaiah. But I think based on the way the letters are written, I think this might be going back 2,000 years to Second Temple times. And that's an astounding thing. Nobody has ever found anything this old. It's huge. Three of the scrolls are bought by Sukenik. They're actually bought on a very interesting day. They are bought on November 29th, 1947, okay, the day that the United Nations votes on partition, votes to create a Jewish state and an Arab state in Palestine. So yet another Zionist archaeology connection. Okay. But there are seven whole scrolls that were discovered, besides the countless fragments that are going to be discovered afterwards. Okay, Sukenik buys three scrolls. The other four are sold to somebody named Mar Samuel, an Orthodox patriarch, right, a Christian Eastern Orthodox patriarch, in the Old City. Sukenik, as the War of Independence is going on, keeps going back and forth to the Old City, which is essentially under fire, trying to make a deal with this guy. He won't sell it. And when he will sell it, he can't get the money. And it just doesn't happen. And Sukenik passes away in 1953. In 1954, his son Yigael Yadin goes to New York, and someone informs him that there is a classified ad in the Wall Street Journal that goes like this. For sale, the four Dead Sea Scrolls, biblical manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC, are for sale. An ideal gift to an educational or religious institution, right? It's a great ad. This is really the ad in the Shrine of the Book in the Israel Museum. You can see a copy of this ad. The patriarch needed some cash. He was willing to sell through an intermediary. They didn't want him to know that it was the state of Israel buying it, but through a good Jew in Brooklyn, Yigael Yadin is able to purchase these scrolls, brings them back, right? This is the mid-50s. The Israel Museum is going to be built soon, and one of the most important things that's housed in the new Israel Museum is the scrolls in the shrine of the book, right? And the shrine is built to look like a lot of different things, but among other things, the white top is meant to be the top of this jar, right? Remember we saw, sorry. Okay, we saw the jar. That's what it's supposed to look like. Okay, and what's in the Dead Sea Scrolls? That we're really not going to go into, but it's definitely, if you had to pick your, top 10 archaeological discoveries of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls always makes it in. Okay, and Sukhenik is really very instrumental in getting them for the state of, in first identifying what they are and in getting them for the state of Israel. Okay. Before we leave Sukhenik, we just want to talk a minute. He has a famous son, but he also has a not quite as famous, but also very important wife. Okay, Chasya Sukhenik, was a real pioneer in early childhood education. Okay, she started out running a gan, running a children's a kindergarten. She eventually ends up running the seminary that trains all the gananot, all the early childhood educators. She was very progressive up until her time. What did it mean to go to kindergarten? You sat in a chair and you listened to the teacher. She was the one who started to do, no, we have to be active, we have to be experiential, we have to go out and see nature. And that was, she doesn't look so, revolutionary. But she really was. And the other thing that she did that was a very big deal was she insisted that her gan be in Hebrew. Now you say, well, that's not such a big deal. And in 1913, there was something called the Language Wars. That's what you see in the poster over here. Ignited by the Technion in Haifa, which wanted its language of instruction to be, of all things, German. And Hebraists in Israel fought back and they said, no way, we're followers of Eliezer ben Yehuda. Hebrew is our language. We want everything to be Ivrit. And it was a real battle, and the Hebraists won. But a more conservative chain called the Ezra chain, right? From Hildesheimer Seminary in Germany, they wanted education to be in German. And Chasya's gan was in the Ezra, world. And she refused. She pulled out, she created her own gan in Hebrew, and not so simple, right? She had to commission writers, poets to create Hebrew songs, Hebrew poetry, Hebrew stories, because they didn't have them. So Chasya Sukhenik, maybe not as famous as her husband or her son, but very important. Okay, Yaakov Finkelfeld is a very sad story because it's really a life cut short. Although we'll see, a lot of these archaeologists did not live to very long days, but his life really was cut short by a terror attack. Yaakov Finkelfeld was an architect as well as a researcher. Not technically an archaeologist, but he was very interested in archaeology. His specialty was he was interested in synagogues. In 1967, in 1948, excuse me, in 1948, when we lost the old city, we still were able to hold on to Mount Zion, right? If you see the picture over here, Sephardic Synagogue of Mount Zion, established during the War of Independence, 1948. On Mount Zion is a very important place called Kever David, the tomb of King David, and just very much harmed by the snipers, by the bombs, by all the battles. Just as a side note, Jews not had not been allowed into Kever David for centuries. The Muslims that controlled it, and with very few exceptions, Jews were not allowed inside. So when we took over Mount Zion, Finkelfeld was in charge of the renovation of Kever David to open it up for visitors. Just FYI, it became the most important Jewish religious site between 48 and 67 because you couldn't go to the Western Wall and you couldn't go to the Temple Mount. You couldn't go to any place in the Old City, but you could go to David's tomb. So he's involved in renovating it. And in renovating it, he uncovers a large chamber underneath, which he suggested might have been a synagogue from Second Temple times, and also helps us to understand a little more, was this really King David's tomb? Was it a tomb that goes back to First Temple times, right? Very interesting question, and he's part of that whole story. What happens to him? In 1956, There's a conference of researchers and archaeologists in Ramat Rachel. We're going to talk about Ramat Rachel in a few minutes. It's a very important site in the south of Jerusalem. It was a kibbutz, many battles there, but it's also a very important archaeological site. And as they're getting ready to start excavating it for real, they hold a conference there. And as the researchers and the archaeologists are up on a water tower, kind of looking out at the view, there's a Jordanian sniper not far away in the Jordanian-controlled area of the Mar Elias Monastery, and he shoots and he kills four people, four of these archaeologists, and Thinkerfeld is one of them. It's a very devastating event because we don't have so many archaeologists in the 50s. I mean, it's a terrible thing no matter what, but it also really, really mows down people who are this is just the very beginnings of the field. And since we're talking about Ramat Rachel, we're going to go to Yohanan Aharoni. Okay, Yohanan Aharoni is already second generation. We're going to come back to one of his teachers, Binyamin Mazar, but Yohanan Aharoni is a little bit later. So he's not one of the founders of the School of Archaeology at Hebrew University. He's one of the first generation of students. Okay? And he studies in Hebrew University under Binyamin Mazar. Then he's hired as a teacher. He teaches there until 1968. And then he moves to Tel Aviv University for the rest of his career. Now, the split between the schools of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv in archaeology is very important. That's something we're going to come back to in our fourth class when we talk about Tanakh and archaeology. I keep saying we're going to come back to it. Really, we will. But just be aware that he joins the Tel Aviv school. He did surveys in many places in the country, right? He excavated in Tel Arad. He excavated, as we're going to see, in Ramat Rachel. But he also did a lot of surveys in the Negev, in the Judean desert, in the Galilee. What's a survey? A survey is looking at a large area and saying, okay, what do we need to excavate here? What are places of interest, right? It's not an excavation, it's discovering places of interest. And his focus was on biblical times, first temple times, and probably his most lasting contribution to Israeli archaeology is not his excavations, but the atlas that he puts out, right? The Atlas Karta L'Tkufat HaMikra. Karta is the atlas company, and they have modern road maps, but they also have many historical atlases. And the biblical atlas, right, that's Yohanan Aharoni and Anson Rainey, as you can see on the name here, right? It's been redone. I think they're already in the fifth edition, but it's very important if we talk about Encyclopedia Mikra'it as like the encyclopedia modern way of looking at the Bible with using, science. The Atlas is a much more user-friendly, right? Maps that show you things like where are the ancient kingdoms of the Fertile Crescent, right? What's the route that Abraham is taking when he goes from Ur Kasdim to the land of Israel? What are the cities that are in the different Nachalot, right? What's Judah's portion? What's Benjamin's portion? What were the battles that happened, right? All of these things, it's an indispensable tool for anyone who is teaching Tanakh and wants to understand the land, and that's really a major contribution that he makes. So very, very significant. Of his digs, we're just going to talk about Ramat Rachel. Okay, Ramat Rachel, we already mentioned, but just to understand, southern area of Jerusalem, originally founded as a kibbutz outside of Jerusalem. Today, it's within the city limits of Jerusalem. It's essentially the archaeological site is discovered. The kibbutz is created already in the 1920s. And it's always known battles because it's always been in a border area. So in 1929 riots, they had to leave, then they come back. And in the battles of the War of Independence, they are attacked by both the Jordanians and the Egyptians. Fierce battles, the kibbutz falls and is regained three times until finally in 1948, when the war is over, it remains in Israeli hands. But between 48 and 67, it's on the border with Jordan. So it's a very, very vulnerable place. And because of that, the army has to come, the defenders, the residents of the kibbutz dig trenches, dig bunkers. And while they're doing that, they come upon archaeology, right? And it's very hard to excavate there because of all the battles that take place. But Yohanan Aharoni comes along, digs here in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, early 60s, and discovers that this is some kind of a very important compound. It has elements of royalty. So you can see these are copies, but these are called proto-Aeolic columns, capitals, sorry, proto-Aeolic capitals. These are found in sites in the land of Israel that were royal cities. They're found in Hazor and in Ir David and in Megiddo and in Shomron, right? So if we're finding them in Ramat Rachel, it's telling you this is someplace royal, someplace important. Okay, we also found like sort of miniature ones of them as a window balustrade. Yohanan Aharoni also found elements of stones that had traces of red paint on them. Now, all of these different things combined with his being able to date this place to the 600s before the Common Era made him say, okay, this is a palace that's built by somebody that Jeremiah castigates for his greed and his being a terrible king. Right, this is Yirmiyahu Chaf Bet. Hoy bone beito b'lo tzedek, liotav b'lo mishpat. He who builds his house with unfairness and his upper chambers with injustice. Who is this? This is King Jehoiakim, okay? One of the last kings of Judah, famously evil king. And Yochanan Aharoni is sure that this is Jehoiakim's palace, his summer palace. We know he has a winter palace in Jerusalem. This is outside of Jerusalem. This is a summer palace. Today, excavations in Ramat Rachel lean in a different direction, but Aharoni, and this was very much in the spirit of the times, he goes to the president's house where there are Bible sessions and researchers who present their findings, and he reads out these psukim, which of course are very powerful, and he says, "I found Jehoiakim's palace." Right? Again, did he? Today, researchers say no. This is a palace that was controlled by outsiders, Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, using elements of Judean and Israelite architecture. Okay. Things change, different theories, different times. Okay. One of the very significant archaeologists, both in terms of his being a teacher to many later students, as well as actually not just like us, academic family, but his real family are an archaeological dynasty. So this is Binyamin Mazar. Binyamin Mazar already is in the beginning of Hebrew University archaeology. He's one of the early people to dig in Beit Sha'arim, okay, and he continues to dig after the Six-Day War. So his career really spans pre-state, in the state, and post Six-Day War. So here's a picture of him as a very young man. And the picture on the right here is kind of in the middle of his career. If you remember, way back 40 minutes ago, we talked about Tel Kasila. All right, Tel Kasila, that was this site in what today is Tel Aviv, then it was on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, that was excavated and turned out to be a Philistine period town. But its significance is not in what they found. They found important things, but there are other Philistine sites. It's not the most exciting site. Its significance is that it's the first site where the state of Israel gave an archaeologist a permit, a license to dig. Okay? And Binyamin Mazar is the guy who gets that license. So that's really its historical significance today. If you want to see it, go to the Eretz Yisrael Museum and you can actually see the tell. There's temples there, there's streets, and it's interesting. But he starts out his career in a place called Beit Sha'arim. Okay, Beit Sha'arim, you can see on the map over here, not so far from Haifa, right? On the edge of the Jezreel Valley. This was a place that its Arab name was Sheikh Abrech, and that's how everybody knew it. It was guarded. It was an Arab town. It was not a Jewish place, but Jews wanted to have a presence there. And one of the early members of Hashomer, right? The guards, the Hebrew guards, the Jewish guards, somebody named Alexander Zide. He goes over there to kind of guard it. He's eventually murdered by Arab terrorists. But before that happens, he's kind of sees himself as an amateur archaeologist. And he explores around and he sees that there are caves there, which had already been seen by other people. And he goes in and he sees an inscription and he sees a menorah and he writes his buddy Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, right? All these guys know each other. And he says, "Look, there's stuff here. Send your friend Binyamin Mazar, Binyamin Meisler, right? Is what he called him. He hadn't changed his name yet. Send him to check things out." And Binyamin Mazar and another important early archaeologist, Nachman Abigad, they come and they start to excavate. They dig here in the 30s, and then they dig again in the 50s, and they find remains of a town, which we now say is Beit She'arim. Beit She'arim, according to the Gemara, is the home of Rabbi Judah the Prince, of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Very, very important place. And they find this amazing necropolis, right? They find caves, burial caves, all over the place, filled with fabulous sarcophagi, and what we're pretty sure is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's grave, right? It's really an amazing thing. So they come, they dig here. Why does this become such an important necropolis? Because, like a lot of places, if you have somebody famous, important, holy buried there, other people want to come and be buried there too. And in their excavations here, they really discovered that you had people coming from all over the Jewish world. We have inscriptions from Palmyra and Alexandria and all different places, different languages, and as we're going to see, a lot of different cultural connections. One of the things that's very nice is that besides the like very large burial caves, you also have like these family caves that have niches that fit with the way the Mishnah in Bava Batra describes what a burial cave should look like, right? Bava Batra, describes, if you buy a bathhouse, what should the bathhouse include? And if you buy a courtyard, what should the courtyard include? And if you buy a burial cave, what should the burial cave include? And it has to have a certain number of niches, certain number of certain sizes, certain openings, and this fits more or less with what we find in Beit She'arim. So that's always very nice. Something that doesn't fit so well is the artwork that's found here. Okay, so first of all, we have this famous Gemara, this very nice Gemara in Ketubot that talks about how people would go all out. They would go crazy on their burial, right? Today, you go crazy on a wedding or a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. Then it was all about the burial, right? So you have this Gemara, which talks about a great instance of rabbinic leadership. Right? Initially, the funeral expenditures for the deceased were more taxing for his relatives than his deaths, right? They made these burials so fabulous until it reached a point where people would abandon the deceased and flee. They didn't have money to pay. This continued until Rabban Gamliel came and conducted himself in a self-deprecatory manner, instructing the people to take him for burial in plain linen garments. And all the people followed his example, right? It's very nice. The Gemara says Rabban Gamliel was a true leader. People followed example. It's very nice, except it wasn't always true. Okay? And people still went all out, keeping up with the Cohens, doing something fabulous. Not only did they go all out, but they often did things that, let's just say, the rabbis would not have been so pleased with. So here, this is probably the most egregious example. This is a sarcophagi, right? A coffin from Beit She'arim, which has an image of a Greek myth, and it's a pretty horrible Greek myth, of Leda and the swan, right? Leda and the swan is Zeus, the god, transforms himself into a swan so that he can rape this young maiden, Leda. This is what somebody thought would be appropriate for his sarcophagus. Not exactly fitting with Rabban Gamliel or any of the other rabbis. Okay, a little less egregious, but still, like, fascinating. You have so many different styles and things that some of the rabbis would have said, fine, beautiful, big carved menorah on the wall. Some they would have said, maybe we like this, maybe we don't. Lions, eagles, bulls, right? All kinds of symbols of strength. something like, I don't know if you can see this here. This is the goddess Nike of the sneakers, right? Putting the goddess Nike on your sarcophagus. So it shows us the variety of beliefs, and the variety of people who came to be buried in this place. They wanted to come here because Rebbe is here, but are they following in all the ideas that Rebbe had? Rebbe's tomb, by the way, is very, very plain, very simple, no sarcophagi, nothing. So, he was true to the way that he believed, but other people know, and there's a variety of religious experience, and it's really a very interesting thing. Okay, Binyamin Mazar's career continues, and after the Six-Day War, he's not such a young man anymore, but he's involved in the very important excavations at the foot of the Temple Mount, what we call today the Southern Wall, okay, the Chulda Gate, the steps, okay, so we have important stuff from Second Temple times, okay, remember that street, Robinson's Arch, we looked at last time with Robinson, so now this is all starting to be excavated and understanding this monumental entrances into the Second Temple. But he doesn't only excavate there. Later, this is in the late 60s, early 70s, later, really at the end of his career in the 80s, he excavates with his granddaughter, who we're going to see in a minute, Eilat Mazar, a little further down from these steps, and he discovers one of the areas that was the palace and the wall of King Solomon. And he finds these huge jugs called pitoi. You can see reconstructions of them here. One of them has on it the ancient Hebrew letters that say, Sar Ha'o. Sar Ha'o. Maybe Sar Ha'ofim. Maybe this was like a jug that was for the baker. It had flour in it, right? Another one of these has a etching of a palm tree. Maybe it had dates or date honey, Silan, right? But it's part of this royal complex from First Temple times, besides also being an area in Second Temple times that's the entrance to the Beit HaMikdash. As I said before, Mazar has not just an academic dynasty, but an actual family dynasty of archaeologists. His granddaughter, who writes very beautifully, like how as a preteen, she already went with her grandfather when he was excavating there by the southern wall, and then she continued and excavated together with him in the 80s. That's Eilat Mazar. You could see her here. This is something that she found from later, from Muslim times, from the 7th century, near the Temple Mount, right? This beautiful jewelry with menorah on it. His nephew is Ami Mazar. Eilat Mazar died too young. She had cancer. She died in 2021. Ami Mazar is still around. He's excavating. He excavated in Beit Shan, and he excavated in a place called Tel Rehov in the Beit Shan Valley, where he found, and this is really a cool thing, he found 30 clay beehives from First Temple times. Okay, up until he found them, the only thing we knew about honey in the Bible was either date honey, right? Seven species. We have dvash. Dvash is date honey. And we heard about wild honey, right? Shimshon kills the lion, and then there's a beehive in his innards, wild honey. Hey, okay, but did people actually produce honey? Did they have domesticated bees until Ami Mazar found these? We didn't know that. And then he found not only these beehives, right? These human-made beehives, but inside he found remains of honey and of bees. So we know for sure that that's really what it was. So that's also a very cool thing. Okay,
Also,
1960, jumping ahead a little bit.
surely.
1960, there are a lot of artifacts that are showing up on the antiquities market, and archaeologists in Israel are concerned that there are all kinds of thieves that are finding caves in the desert, breaking into them, stealing artifacts, and selling them on the antiquities market. And that's very bad. We want to know where things come from. We want to know their context. So, Yigael Yadin, who you can see again, right? This is our third picture of him. Wow. He wins the prize for today's PowerPoint. He, and we haven't even talked about him, right? He goes to the government, right? He goes to Ben Gurion and he says, I think we should do a lightning mission, use the resources of the army, and go and explore the caves in the Judean desert so that we can find things, right? Be proactive. Go find them before the thieves find them. Now, remember, this is 1960, okay? So the northernmost part in the Judean desert that we have access to is En Gedi. Further north of that is Jordan, okay? So the plan is to do this 2-week mission from En Gedi down towards Nahal Saalim, not so far from Masada, to divide it up into 4 sectors to use the army, because as you can see in the picture on the right here, many of these caves were really very, very difficult to access. You needed rope ladders, you needed helicopters, you needed a lot of resources, and to see what they can find. Okay? And they divided up into 4 sectors. You had 4 different archaeologists, Yadin, Yochanan Aharoni, who we already mentioned, Pesach Bar Adon, and Nachman Avigad, who we're going to talk about towards the end here. And they don't know what they're going to find. They really don't know. Yadin gets the northernmost section. He's kind of pessimistic. He's like, oh, they're not going to find anything there. He actually has the most exciting finds. So we're going to talk about 2 places, actually. Okay. Something called the Cave of the Treasure in Nachal Mishmar. Okay. Nachal Mishmar, not in Yadin section, in Pesach Bar Adon section. And they find this incredible treasure, more than 400 pieces, scepters and balls and crowns, right? Nobody knows what these things were used for. When archaeologists don't know what something is used for, they say, oh, ritual. It must have been used for ritual purposes. There was some kind of temple here. The catch is, the fascinating thing is that this goes back to what's called the Chalcolithic period, meaning before the Canaanites, more than 5,000 years ago. There's some temple out here in the Judean desert. What did they worship? What did they believe in? We really don't know a lot about it, but they created these beautiful, beautiful objects and hid them in the caves here. Okay, so that's one amazing find. The other amazing find is from 1800 years ago. Okay, and that's from the time period of Bar Kokhba. Okay, from Bar Kokhba in something called the Cave of Letters, Yadin finds caches of documents, amazing documents. This is one that was found wrapped up. Okay, we're going to see what they are in a minute. Why are there documents in these caves? So basically, what happened during the Bar Kokhba revolt is that people left their homes. First, they hid out in underground caverns in their towns. But as things started to get worse, as the Romans started to be successful, the Jews escaped through whatever canyon, whatever wadi was closest to their towns, and made their way out to the Judean desert. The Judean desert is always a place of refuge. They took stuff with them. Okay? Some of the stuff shows that they were really well-off families, and they also packed their stuff really well. This glass dish did not come. Yadin jokes in his book. He writes, when we unwrapped this, it was very, very painstakingly wrapped up. He said, I half expected to turn it over and see made in China on the bottom, because that's how perfect it was. Okay? They took their dishes with them. They took clothing with them. We found examples, pieces of dyed cloth. These were people who had resources. They took, and this I think is the most heartbreaking thing, they took their keys. That's what this is on the right. They took their keys with them. They thought they were going to go home again. They didn't go home again because the Romans are victorious. The Bar Kokhba rebels are viciously put down. The homes are destroyed. The villages are destroyed, and people don't go home again. And these items stay in the caves. Now, Yadin finds a few things that are fascinating. One, he finds a cache of documents of somebody named Babta. Babta was a lady who was married a couple of times. She had a rather complicated life. She owned property. She tried to defend property. She had divorce documents. She had property documents. What's so interesting is that by seeing her documents, we get a glimpse of the legal system of the time. And this is for anybody who's been learning Daf Yomi, right? Just last week, this week, we've been talking about different types of documents. And some are called tied documents, get mikushar, right? A document that's tied and sewed up with signatures on the outside. We have documents that look just like that from Babta's archive. So it's really fascinating to see where these documents look like what the rabbis talk about, where they diverge from them. It's an amazing discovery. But the discovery that really made headlines was that Yadin found documents that were written by a guy. I hope you all can see this. I'll annotate it. Okay. That were written by a guy who signs his name Shimon ben Kuzba, or Shimon Nisi Yisrael. Who is this? This is Shimon bar Koziba, who we know better as Shimon bar Kochba. Up until now, we only knew about bar Kochba from what other people wrote about him, Romans, the rabbis. Here we have letters that he wrote himself. So really very, very, very exciting. Okay, we will finish up with Nachman Avigad. Oh, this was just a continuing saga, like literally a minute before October 7th in September 2023, in another cave down near En Gedi, four swords from Roman times, completely intact, perfect, beautiful, with their scabbards, with their outsides, were discovered. So that's just the Bar Kokhba story is not over yet. Okay, Nachman Avigad. We will not do this story justice, but we'll do it quickly. Nachman Avigad, contemporary of Mazar, with him in Beit Shearim. But again, when he's older, he is asked after the Six-Day War to take on this huge project of excavating the Jewish quarter, right? The Jewish quarter, which had been super densely built up, as you can see here in this photograph from before 1948. Jordanians come, destroy the synagogues. Here's the Churva, here's the Tiferet Israel. And when we come back in 1967, we have what he writes here, this extraordinary event. It seemed the old city would never reveal its secrets, and only an extraordinary event would create a situation where it would be possible to do serious excavations in Jerusalem. And that extraordinary event, of course, was 1948, the Jordanians destroying and then not building very much, so that when we came back in 67, okay, we were able to excavate and construct at the same time. And 14 years of intense excavation in the Jewish quarter while the Jewish quarter was being built. And again, this is really like, we should be doing this for an hour. We're just going to do it in 2 minutes. Avigad found evidence of the wall of the city from Chizkiyahu's time and fortifications from the time of the Babylonian attack and the Churban. He found incredible, beautiful houses of the Kohanim from Second Temple times. Okay? And he found the street, the main street of the city from Roman Byzantine times, from the Cardo. Okay, so we really have amazing, amazing discoveries, and that's our post-67 reality. Okay, I see we have many comments, so let's see in the 3 minutes that we have what we can look at. Okay, sorry, I'll just go back to the beginning here. Dead Sea Scrolls, earth or soil, not dirt. Okay, mosaic floor at Beit Alpha. No, the mosaic floor at Beit Alpha is in Beit Alpha. It's not in the New Archaeological Museum, but if you like archaeology and you are in Jerusalem, the New Archaeological Museum is very nice, and they do have a lot of interesting stuff. Yes, amazing discoveries in Chukok. Again, expanding our understanding of what was accepted in a synagogue, right? Which is fascinating. King David and Kever David is a longer, more complicated conversation. But basically, many scholars say not King David, but Malchei Beit David, right? Later kings of the house of David. A song about Sheikh Abrech. Susanna, you sing it for us because I don't know it.
I'm not sure, but the name rang a bell. So I think I've heard it in a song, but I don't know. I thought maybe you
All
might
right.
have.
Find it for us for next week. Dead Sea Scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls have been displayed in a lot of places. Yeah, also in Toronto, where they had protests by Palestinians who talked about how they are true Palestinian artifacts. Yes, always fun to hear these kinds of things. Rabban Gamliel, what year? That's a good question. Which Rabban Gamliel it is? Probably the second, meaning like time of the Churban, but I'm not 100% sure. Chukok and National Geographic, yes, very nice. Okay, Uzishkin, yeah, Uzishkin is also very interesting. Dug with Yadin in Chatzor. When we talk about Chatzor, we'll mention Uzishkin also. He also dug in Lachish. Okay, we have all this Jewish geography here. Okay. Get Nikusha. Yeah, Suzette, you were in that cave. That's so cool. You were in the Cave of Letters.
And I studied that Gemara with David Rosenthal at Hebrew University.
Oh, very cool. But you were actually in the cave is even cooler.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe another class about the Old City. Probably not in this series, but a different time we will do it. Okay. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week. I don't know if anybody else has other questions, but next week, I think what we had planned to do was nature and archaeology. I have to figure out what I want to do exactly. I'm not sure 100%, but I have a whole week to think about it. All right. Thank you, everybody. Have a Shabbat Shalom and Besorot
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Canada.
Thank you,
Thank
Julie.
you from Toronto.
Thank you from Ottawa.
Thank you. You're awesome.
Have a wonderful Shabbat.
Thank you.
Thank
everybody.
You from the Kessels.
Thank you.
Oh, hello, Kessels.